we traveled for many months from May 71. We arrived back in Halifax, Dartmouth Sioux, on August 15th, the day of the big flood that happened in Binook Lake that flooded Dartmouth, downtown Dartmouth. And that was the day that Nixon went virtual and released the fixed exchange rates.
Nixon going virtual? What does that mean?
They took the gold standard and the exchange rate. The dollar was no longer based and anchored on a fixed exchange rate. I think that's what it was. I did not know Zenocchi was happening back then. It's only in retrospect this all makes sense, that I was, you know, going around causing everything. I didn't know that. I could always find out, because if you remember the Dartmouth Ferry, by the 80s, when I was staying at your place at Christmas, I went down there, and they had the Dartmouth Terminal before the new one, I think, unless it is the new one. They had the articles, the newspaper articles for August 15th, 1971, plastered all over the wall as wallpaper. The famous fucking flood was on the wall. And so I'm there standing there. And this is 1984, say. I'm now working with Bob Marshall on the radio. I realize I'm going to be fucking awesome. You know, I've gone electric. I'm going to become chairman of the council. And all that stuff is laid out in 84. And I'm standing there going, holy shit, I fucking caused that flood. There it is, August 15th. Because I always remember dates. I know exactly dates and things. So I remember my life this way. So I realized, holy shit, thank you, Dartmouth. You put up the fucking newspaper articles reminding me. And I actually went to the library the next fucking day to double-check it. So in June, we're with Beefheart. He wants to talk to Dave Wally and says, Dave, why are you doing a biography in Zappa? He's not worth it. He's a good engineer, a good technician, but he's not an artist. And so I heard Beefheart complaining all this shit, and then he called Wally and complained. And then that led to Wally including Beefheart in the book. So thanks to me. In May 71, we stayed at the East Village Other office. You know, we slept there for a week in New York City. And we heard one night, I always remember these, that Dean Latimer and another guy, Rex Wiener, were making that week's East Village Other. And I was up all night listening to them cackle. They were stoned, and they were talking about the girl who fucking went on LSD and roasted her baby. You know, on LSD, hallucinating, and cooked her baby. And they were laughing their heads off, and I was listening. I couldn't sleep. I was listening to them yak and scream about this shit while they were stoned making the East Village Other. And then we went down to Texas and met with some people we knew in Seattle. And then we went to Mexico, and then we went to California, and that's when we spent 6 weeks or more with Jordan Sloan and really learned a lot about the detail. We'd met him earlier in March 70, but now it's the summer 71.
When you went to Mexico, where the hell did you go there in Mexico?
We only did the northern part. We took a train across Monterey and over to the coast. It was ridiculous. We ended up being, you know, in a stupid nowhere place with little Aztec peasants running around, or not running around, limping around, bugging us. See, we were going to California anyway, so we said, well, let's go down and see what Mexico's like. Al Walker and them drove us to the border, and then we went to some place, Monterey, and we hung out there.
So that was from Texas, though. What were you doing in Texas?
Yeah.
Was that when the psychic told you you were going to be...
Yes, Bertie Ketchings. Carolyn wrote it all down. I don't think Carolyn had a session. She didn't believe in any of this shit, or I don't know what she thought, but I had the session because I had read a book about her, and they said she's a good psychic, so I wanted to go to see her, and she was in Austin, Texas, and we hung out in Austin, Texas for 3 weeks. Later, I found out Reverend Stang went to college there in 71, and he was inspired by Firesound Theater. Well, I always remember being in a party in Austin, Texas, around the university area, and they played the Firesound Theater albums. And I don't know if I knew of them then, but I certainly learned about
them. Now, what is the Fireside Theater album?
It's a great comedy group. Did a lot of punning that were friends of McLuhan and out of L.A. They're the one that did McLuhan, you know, the Enola Gay bombed Hiroshima. So they, on their albums, I think it's called Waiting for the Electrician, or We're All Bozos on This Bus. On the album... they have the Enola McLuhan, not the Enola Gay, and the Enola McLuhan is going around the world doing media ecology as laid out by McLuhan in the Playboy interview of March 69. They're going around to say, okay, there's Venezuela. They got too much TV. So they would bomb Venezuela with books. They were bombing different countries with different media. And so they were really good. But I always thought, isn't that interesting? I'm in Austin, Texas, probably the first time I heard them, somebody was playing the album in the party, and that was a big formative thing on Stang within a few months when he was at Austin, Texas. So
wow.
I was in the Subgenius Vortex beforehand. And that's when I saw Little Feat, which had Roy Estrada, who had left the Mother's Invention. I got to talk to him about Zappa. Little Feat just started off then. And we did a lot of things in Austin, Texas with Al Walker and his younger brother. Al Walker was a guy in the Cosmic Awareness Development classes in Seattle in 69 to 70. And in the middle of the Cosmic Awareness Development class, he turned into a Bible-reading fundamentalist. That's what happened to him.
And that was the year before, so that was 1970?
That is September 69 to March 70 when we went down to L.A. to meet Jordan Sloan, to see Frank Zappa, and to see Krishnamurti. That's what we did in March 70. And Worcester and everybody went down there because it was always an annual ritual to go see Krishnamurti with that gang.
Where was that, Krishnamurti?
Santa Monica Auditorium. You can read about that spring in Pinch's book, Inherent Vice, after Manson. In the summer of 69, and then the paranoia in L.A. from that point on. Now, we went to a concert somewhere. I don't know what it was. And Carol and I, we had to go back to our hotel, and we're walking around wondering what to do. Should we go home or should we go somewhere? And all of a sudden, this Volkswagen bus opens the side doors. And I always remember these creepy hippies said, "Hey, you guys want to come with us? Do you need a place to stay?" But I knew, I said, "No, this ain't cool." So we said, "No, thanks, we're okay. We're just going to stay in the hotel over there." Protecting Connie. Connie was a dumb, naive kid. She would have fucking gone in there and never would have seen her again.
You were probably already stepping into the van and she was holding you back.
Yeah, if Carol was here, "No, Bob, I got us out of the van, Bob." That's what Carol would say. But she's napping right now, so we're going to hear Bob's version. But it was a great week and a half. I mean, with meeting Jodan Sloan, we were doing the D-Cell, being at Zappa's, being with Krishnamurti, being with Dave Worcester. It was really amazing. And that's when I first started driving around L.A. at 3 in the morning with Paul Seibel or Worcester driving their car and listening to L.A. car radio. That's the best experience, you know, middle of the night, driving the great L.A. street highways that are empty and hearing great radio. That's probably where I got my genius of how to program radio, listening to L.A. radio. Yeah, with Dave Worcester sitting there in the front passenger seat talking, you know, hyper metaphysics, explaining how Rai returned to essence, the best fucking conversation you could ever have. Me and Carol sitting in the back, and while those guys smoke dope, and we're just sitting there looking around, I'm digging the Johnny Angel songs and all the oldies that they were playing. And it's 3 in the morning. It was Paul Seibel driving the car, riding the car, and Worcester talking his magical way. Like, that is fucking incredible. That's a great memory. Life is worth the memories, you know? Memories are the great things. This is when Ion said we fucked up. In 69, we could have started the Ionic movement. I guess with Dave Worcester. You know, we actually did go out on September 25th, flew out in 69, to offer to help the Cosmic Awareness movement. And they just didn't want to do it, or they were just staying with themselves.
I thought you decided that you didn't want to continue with doing their development classes.
Okay, so we start doing the development classes. That's through September, October, November, December, January, February. You get into February, Dave Worcester comes over, and he's in a bad mood. Right around that time, I'm thinking, well, this could be a cult. We had 12 development classes. We had just done number 10, and I said, I don't think I want to finish this because I don't know if I want to be part of what could be a cult. And so we convinced Al Walker to forego the 11th development class and let's go to a movie or something. And I remember we get in the car and Al Walker drives us around. And Al, he doesn't mind leaving because he's gone fundamentalist. He's gone biblical, you know. So we became the renegade dropouts from the master plan to become the fucking master teachers of the course. And shortly after that, Worcester came over and complaining. But he looked at me and he said, "Bob, you will never forget my face." He made this threat to me or something. Decades later, when I told him about this, because what we did, we then hung around, didn't do the development classes. That pissed off the other people in the house we were living in. And then we went down to L.A., and then we went back up to Seattle, and then traveled back across to Nova Scotia. That's when we get married.
Did you fly back?
I think we flew back. I don't remember a long trip. I do remember a long trip in the summer of 71 where we arrived back on Dartmouth on the flood day. That was a bus trip.
Oh,
okay,
yeah,
just
bus.
To follow the sequence. So we get back in Dartmouth. We get an apartment.
You were considered quite kind of funky and wild. And
when you read the memo to Prince Charles, which
yeah.
we read on the air, where I'm telling Prince Charles about my life with Steve and the mental mutants and all these kids that I did with in 667, and we go to Montreal, and then I come back in the summer of 68. Ed Seaton and all these guys, they get perverted by me. When I'm in Seattle, Dave Worster has Sandoz, really good LSD. It might be Owsley or Sandoz, really incredible LSD. So I sent back LSD to Tommy Hart, to Ed Seaton, to Steve,
now, wait
everybody.
A second now. You did LSD in 68?
I didn't do it. I just said, this stuff is good and people like it. I'll send it back to the kids who want it.
You mailed LSD back in 1968 to the gang at home. But
to
you
the
never
kids.
Tried
they're all still in high school. And I mailed this cosmic LSD to all of them because I got it from Dave Worster. I mean, he always had the best LSD because he got it from Hubbard back in the 50s, you know, when they did the Center of Integration. That's all on the Dave Worster recording, the history of LSD and Dave Worster. They got it before Leary did.
How come you didn't want to try it yourself?
In the Secret Council 10 battles, I was always getting poisoned here and there. You know what I mean? So I never took anything voluntarily. I always end up getting it done to me. Carolyn did, and when we get out there, October 69, she had some really good peyote or mescaline. Carolyn sat there scribbling for like 3 hours. Scribble, scribble. She was getting one big idea after another. It was all like you never saw Carolyn write before. But now she's writing on this notepad all these insights she's getting from the mescaline trip. And then when she came down, she looked at the pad. And you know, you couldn't read one inch of it. It was all a scrawl. But it was like she tapped into her future health writing. We don't know what she was writing. You can't explain it. So Carolyn always did the drugs. You know, I didn't. She was into it.
Well, she was interested in the Mexican spiritual trip thing through the drugs.
Trip.
It wasn't necessarily just going
That's
through
later.
The drugs.
She didn't know anything in 69.
Okay,
she knew
so
a bit about it from our Secret Council 10 information, but she did not have an environment where she would do it. And this place where we end up staying in Seattle was the perfect place. So she did it, and I watched her, scribbling for hours.
So you used Carolyn as your experiment. You just watched the results of the experiment.
Yeah, I was always observing.
Carolyn.
From my intelligence activity, I observed everybody. Everything was a lab, wherever I went. I'm
so you weren't a
effect.
Participant, Bob. You were the observer.
No, I was the MKUltra programmer, MKUltra fucking CIA secret guy who was setting everybody up. I mean, I can remember Dave Worster in a fetal position, lying on the floor, stoned on LSD, and I'm playing Zappa's Lumpy Gravy. I used to play the music just to see what happened to them. Dave was all curled up. Vern was pissed off. They hated the Zappa because it's a collage. Lumpy Gravy is his voice collage, chaos. And I'm zapping him with it. And later, you know, Worster said, you know, Zappa's an amazing, talented musician, but he won't finish a fucking melodic line. He's always jumping from one thing to another. He won't finish it. So I was always probing and exploring and studying. So why am I saying that?
My
so, Carolyn
God.
Took, yeah,
so you
Carolyn
sent
took
it out to all the other kids and you didn't take any of
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So in, let's see, about December, January, I send a little... You know, a little cardboard thing, and you would put the LSD, you know, tape it in a cardboard container, like a pill or something, with its own little cardboard container. So I made about 8 of them, and I sent it to all the kids that are written up in the diaries that include Sue in there. All those kids, Alan, Steve, that I do the diaries.
And they all went insane.
They did. They all went fucking nuts. It's incredible. So I sent this powerful LSD. And none of them had ever had LSD. They're all in high school, you know, like 18. Steve's a little older. So when I come back in April 70, there's a big happy reunion. Bob's back, and I'm there, you know, giving audience to hear how did the LSD happen. I thought they'd love the LSD. This one guy, he lived in the basement of his home, and I won't say the names. He tore down all the posters. He went nuts and tore apart his fucking basement apartment in his family home. Another guy did another freak out and did something weird. Another guy, the world cracked. He said, the world became a big split mirror, and a big fucking snake came out of the mirror and attacked me.
They never had any experience with LSD. It was the first time. They probably never even heard stories of it.
Yeah, they didn't
even
know what was happening.
Plus, it was probably so pure. It was pure.
Very pure, very powerful. It was totally irresponsible what I did in some levels. I think Steve had a good trip. But he always said there was some hang-up that happened to him. But he had a pretty basic good trip, Steve did. But the rest of them, everyone was like, scary. One of them ends up becoming a junkie. I mean, a lot of them had bad fate for the next couple of years. They had to recover. But they did not complain to me. They just thought it was great to have this experience. They would never do it again, they thought. They said it wasn't pleasant, but it was unique that they got to have the famous LSD experience. I always got away with everything. Everybody, said, yeah, Bob, you're great. I almost killed myself. I love you, Bob. Anyway, so that is April, May, 70. Okay, we had very low on funds. So Carolyn decided that, like, she'd done her traveling. We'd done it for a couple of years. She said, I'm going to go back to college. I think she was thinking some medicinal role, but never thought of being a doctor. So she had to get some credit. So she spent that summer reading a high school physics book or a chemistry book. She had to get a scientific credit that she didn't have. Now, Karen wasn't in high school, and she was a lot older, and a lot of this is covering up where we were, okay? You have to realize Karen was born in 1922. She will not tell you that. She will deny it. All this shit about my mother did this, that's all fucking lies, because she tries to pretend she was born in Newfoundland and all this crazy story. But she had to get some credits. So she was deciding that the 70s were going to be different and that she couldn't really work for the City Council 10, sort of started to think of getting out of the City Council 10. So she started to create her own career, which a lot of women were starting to think right then. That's right when women's lib starts, 68, 69. Women started saying, no, I'm not going to be dependent on a husband or something, and I wasn't a perfect guy to be dependent on. So we had to fake being normal. Okay, we're back. We're hiding. Nixon's gotten in. Certain things haven't worked out. I'm avoiding the Ionic mission for whatever reason. I'm supposed to fucking save the world in 69, but I'm not. I remember I said, Carolyn, I don't really need the money, but I need to get a cover. Where can I work? A guy, Nolan, told me there's a company called Phillips Cables. Anybody can get a job there. You go out there and you let cable wire on its spools or something. I actually got a job, and I did this thing, this labor job, for 3 weeks. I just was faking looking normal because there was a lot of bullshit behind the scenes. You can read in the diary. A lot of battles. I mean, there was no way that I was in any power in that level. I mean, the factions were fighting viciously, and I was vulnerable. So I had to look respectable and get a cover. So I worked at Phillips Cables. So I do 3 weeks. Now we're into May, and now Carol and I are going to get married. So I say, you know what? If I'm going to get fucking married, I'm buying a stereo. Because how the hell can you fucking be happy with a fucking marriage without some fucking music? So I go to the Dartmouth Shopping Center to Steve Schneiderman's store. So I said, okay, I'd like to buy this stereo here. I said, I don't have the money here. I have to do it on credit. So he said, okay, where do you work? I work at Phillips Cables. So I'm sitting in the back office of the stereo store. He calls Phillips Cable. He looks rather serious. He's going, okay. And he says, okay. So he slowly hangs up the phone and looks at me. He says, I'm sorry, Bob, we can't do this. I said, why? You've been fired.
Why? What happened?
Well, it turned out that there was a 3-week probation. They watched you for 3 weeks, and definitely I was not acting normal. I used to talk too much to people, talk to all the guys, eat normal lunches. I don't know. I looked odd. And I was being watched by the foreman. He decided after 3 weeks that I should not work there, and I did not know that. I would have found out within a day or so when I went back there, but I found out from the guy, Steve Schneiderman, who ended up being a goalie on my ball hockey team a couple of years later, So I didn't know him then, but he always remembered that he had to fire me.
The only job you've ever had, and you didn't even know you got fired.
Well, no, two jobs. Okay, now I'm getting married, and I got no fucking job. I probably get the job on April 22nd, you know, the famous date, 4/22.
Yeah.
April 22nd, 1970, and I lasted till the first week or two of May. So then I'm walking around in Halifax, and I come across Jack Weenus, a guy from way back. And I said, where can one get a job around here? And he said, go to Park Victoria. You remember Park Victoria, Sue? It was like a big high-rise apartment in 10 stories for college students and stuff. So,
oh, yeah, it was very exclusive.
Right, in 1970. So Jack said he had worked there, and he said, you could probably get a job as a janitor. So I go over there, and I get a job as a janitor there. My boss a black guy whose name is John Kane, K-A-N-E. But, of course, we become great friends really fast. He's a jazz aficionado. So I start going over to his post-Africville slum place and listening to John Coltrane records.
Oh.
And he came over to our place. We lived at 242 Wimmer Road. I found out later, all of 1970 in the news world was occupied with Resolution 242 about what to do with Palestine in relation to Israel. And we were living at 242 Windmill, so there was the Socrates. Which is 22 also, 242.
Oh, my God.
So John Kane, I started calling him John Colcane for Coltrane. And, of course, he came over one night and met Carolyn, and he fell in love with Carolyn. I had to fucking keep him off from coming over and raping or raiding Carolyn somehow. I mean, he was fixated on Carolyn because we weren't married. We were living together. So he felt, well, this is open season. I used to tell people, oh, you like Carolyn? Well, give it a go. You can ask her for a date, see what she says. And they all backed off. If you let them do it, they were suspicious of me. You know, oh, yeah, yeah.
Of course.
They fucking knife the shit out of me if I tried it. So here it is. We're now coming up to June 9th, 1970. I've been working at Park Victoria for 3 or 4 weeks. I've got to go get married in the civil service. You know, the courthouse was just down the street from Park Victoria. So here it is. I'm going to have a civil marriage. I'm meeting Carolyn at 4 o'clock. I'm with John Cocaine. We used to buzz off, not do the janitor work, you know. I mean, I was good at a job for about 2 days. After that, I could not do it anymore. It was too repetitive. I had things to think about. I had fucking people to talk to. I had janitors to turn on to Sun Ra and all this stuff. So I said, John, I've got to get married at 4. Will you cover for me? You weren't allowed out till 5 or 5:30.
Oh,
can you cover for me while I take off at 3:45 to go get married? And he said, I'll cover for you, Bob. So I leave at 3:45, run down to the courthouse. There's Carolyn with Phil McKay and his wife. He had gotten married a year before. He had to get married. He was going to be the witness. You have to have a witness at the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
So Phil McKay and maybe Lori Jeffers. I think Carolyn knew Lori Jeffers. So we did the courthouse marriage. You know, you do the ceremony. I did not have a fucking ring. Carolyn bought a ring on the way, a $10 ring at Kmart. She brought over this fucking little dinky thing on the way over from Dartmouth. So I give her the ring, and we do the ceremony, and I kiss her. I do the vows. And then we leave the courthouse. We walk across to the library, and there was a church beside the library, and we had photos taken of ourselves standing in front of the church as if we had a church marriage.
In your janitor uniform?
I had a tie or a tweed jacket. Carolyn had a bit of a dress on. The witnesses were way better dressed than me.
Meanwhile, you had to get back to work.
No, I didn't have to go back to work. But what happened is that Phil McKay and his wife went back to their apartment in Halifax. They made us some supper. We then went to the lobster trap to watch strippers. So we go to the lobster with Phil and his wife, and we sit there, and then they drive us home, and we go back home to 242 Windmill Road. And it was just a formality. We just, for some reason, we thought we should get married, and we did it. And then we carried on the way we're doing. And then 6 weeks later, we went on our honeymoon, and we went to New York City. Oh, yeah, yeah.
With Steve.
Yeah, with Steve. Here's the thing. I forgot. Okay, so I go back to the job. Within a
honeymoon
few weeks, I'm
Steve.
Fired from the janitor job, okay? I get fired from the fucking janitor job a few weeks later. fuck this being fucking normal and civilized. I said, I'm going into my secret bank account. We're going to start going back to our secret council of 10 life and be secret. So we then flew to New York. Steve came along. We paid for his trip, probably. And we flew to New York and spent a week with Sun Ra, who 8 or 10 years later announces that a voice will come from another dimension and cause you to change. This fucking guy, we knew to go see him for our honeymoon. It was a very spiritual honeymoon. And that's when I met a lot of the East Village Other guys. I just missed meeting Walter Boward. He had quit the East Village Other. I met Lee Delescu, Dean Latimer. Don't think I met Dave Wally yet. Now, okay, so we do in July 22nd, probably a week or so in New York. Then we come back, and Carolyn writes her high school exam and passes it. And then Carolyn goes to Dalhousie and takes a science fiction course from Friedberg.
What do you mean a science fiction course?
She took a course on taught science fiction by Edgar Friedberg. She's thinking that she has to go to university and get something medical. So she got her high school filler that she was minus on because she didn't have this education in Paris, didn't have this background. So she knew that she had to have certain course requirements even to go to college. She didn't have it. So she did the physics and chemistry exam that summer and passed them in early September. Now she could go to university. She took two courses. One was science fiction, and Joanne Coffey was in the class. And that's how she met Joanne Coffey. And then there was another course she took. She took two courses. Okay, so Carolyn decided that maybe she should get a job. So she became a stenographer for a company in Scotia Square, which is where Sue met 14 years later, meets the Alan Zavod of the band, Zappa's band, that leads us to see Frank. That building, Scotia Square. So we were God planting stuff in the past to be activated later. So Carol, by sitting in Scotia Square Mall for a few weeks as a secretary job, set that up. So we get through the winter.
So she learned stenography in high school?
No, she had learned it in her intelligence world. She's always been a typist. I mean, she's an incredibly fast typist. We all heard it on the sessions, right? She learned it in Paris. In the spring of 71, I decide that I've got to go see McLuhan again. So I go up there the first week of March 71. And I read him what Cosmic Awareness said about him. And he said, that sounds like a lot of double talk. And he points to a pair of glasses on his table. He says, see those glasses? That's an example of what I do. I take something like these glasses, and I go, what are these, and where do they come from? I analyze the glasses, which is like analyzing objects around you grammatically. Where do they come from? What are they? What are the effects? So that was an interesting answer. That sort of showed me something. So I'm up there for a week with McLuhan, and some interesting events. He gave a lecture on modern poetry and all that, and he was yelling at the promoter on the side because the guy didn't promote it properly. I remember Marshall being pissed. And then when he gave the talk, he had a slide behind him, one image, and it was the view from his coach house, from his office, looking out on a dead parking lot. That's what he offered. He offered a picture of the view from his coach house as the backdrop to his lecture. So it was almost like, this is the view from where I am. You know what I mean? The environment as art form. So it was very interesting how he had that picture as his demonstration photo.
So you mean that he was showing that photograph of the
empty... There was a slide behind him. He was sitting there with a table and a lamp and reading through text and making a lecture. It was a literary lecture. But behind him was a ridiculous slide photograph of a parking lot.
It was almost like a photograph of empty space. So that he could actually create what he wanted to create in the empty space.
No, but it wasn't. It was his view from his office. He's presenting the view from his building. From where I live, which is his office, this is what I see.
When you see something like that, doesn't it sort of tell you you're looking at empty space so that you can create whatever you want in your own mind to fill that empty space?
Maybe that could fit. Because he was in interviews around that time saying he's not going to write books anymore, he's going to make movies. So he was thinking of post-verbal media. You know how he made this movie? They ran a projector with no content on a wall. And he said you had to adjust the sound and the lighting on the blank wall with nothing in the camera. It's ridiculous what he says. You know, he's working with
well,
no
isn't
content.
That so people could think their own thoughts and create their own meaning
yeah.
on their own lives by giving
Maybe.
Them some empty space
well, he was,
that they could
that,
create
That's
in?
Natural, Sue. That's user's content.
Like the blank,
what he was trying to
the
show
blank casing.
How you adjust the environment. He was showing how you adjust the screen to the projector to the environment. The adjustment to the environment. The figure-ground relationship was what Mediacology is about. He didn't bother having any content. And yes, you could project user's content on the empty screen, but he was saying it was very important to adjust the lighting levels with this non-existent film. So he was working with the form, not the content.
Was he doing that really because the content was not important anymore and the content had disappeared?
No, it wasn't important. The user was the content. That's why he said CRTC, the rulings that records had to have 10 or 15% Canadian content, the Anne Murray phenomenon, CRTC, ruling too much American media taking over Canada, so they said we got to have 20%, 30% broadcasting of Canadian groups and musicians. McLuhan said that was absurd. If you have a Palestinian living in Toronto listening to music, it's not Canadian music, it's not American music, it's Palestinian music, because the Palestinians will project their own experience into the Beatles song. So the
right,
user
right,
is
right.
the content. You can never control
right.
the user's interpretation. But the,
it's the viewer
the
who looks at the parking lot that creates
yes.
the parking lot?
Creates their interpretation of it, whatever meaning they get from it. But McLuhan is pointing out you got a dark room with one slide and a light on a table and he's reading from a book. He would explain the adjustment of those props as more important than any content. The environmental control,
and
sensory input, was important.
So were the using of these props because of the emotional nature of the viewer as content?
No, you couldn't control the user. You could shift his sensory preferences or the group that was watching it. You're molding the environment. The medium is the message. So you're working with the form. The content's not important.
So and so, therefore, the viewer is not important either.
Viewer is not important.
So the viewer is not important. The content's not important. It's just what you're talking about is the
effect
is,
of the camera on the other
right.
media in the room. What's the effect on books? What's the effect on the poster on the wall? What's the effect on the glasses that people are wearing? It's a,
but not on the viewer itself.
Yeah. McLuhan said the user is always the content, and that never changes. It's the content of whatever the user is. But you can change the sensory dynamics of the crowd and of a little bit of the user. But mainly it's to change on other media. The medium is a message refers to previous media when you bring in a new technology. You don't
okay.
know what the new technology is. You can't see the effects, so you watch how the older media change, and you notice they're changing. How are they changing? What's happening? And that's the clue to what is the characteristics of the new invisible technology. So, you know, a week or so in Toronto, I go back to Nova Scotia, and what's the big news story? While I was with McLuhan, Margaret Trudeau had a secret wedding with Pierre Trudeau, I think on March 6, 1971. The big thing in Canadian culture was that secret wedding. Anyways, it was a big deal that he had married this young woman, and nobody knew this was going to happen. So I always thought it was mm-hmm. interesting that Trudeau was McLuhan's best buddy. They were best friends, and I was sitting with McLuhan on the day they got married. So I should tell you something. I was
so
with Trudeau's
don't tell
best
me that
friend.
Trudeau was really was his best buddy.
Trudeau always stayed at Marshall's house when he came to Toronto. And he also got very involved with some relatives of McLuhan after he got divorced.
Hmm.
I'll just say that. And I know a lot of this from Mary. Mary told me all this, one of the daughters. So anyways,
one of the McLuhan daughters, maybe.
I'm not saying anything. I said relatives. So Trudeau and McLuhan were very involved with each other. I tell the story that the guy I met in Maui, David Greenberg, he provides the last project for McLuhan, the TV series down in L.A.